All right, so before I begin, I just like to point out a transformation of a mindset that we need to do. During the last couple of weeks, your mind was captured in the twisted magnetic field lines, scorched by very strong radiation fields, rapidly rotating and nearing the end, the region where, not even the brightest of you would be able to emit any light anymore, right, to anybody who would detect it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be talking about regions that are much farther away from the black hole by 3-5 orders of magnitude. So we're much more quieter. The temperature is actually not that much different from Santa Barbara. They are actually somewhat dusty, but not as dusty as Santa Barbara. And, quite...
Optical depth?
Yeah?
What about the optical depth?
The optical depth? depends on wavelength. So, you can just relax there, really, but not too much, because if you're too massive, you can gravitationally collapse. On the other hand, if you do, then you form a star. And, who wouldn't want to be a star, right? People say, you became a star. So that's really the summary of my talk. A bit more extended outline is that first I want to give you introduction to Sir J. Starr, then want to point out this paradox of youth, how we call it for young massive stars there. There are two models for formation of these stars, and one is info of a massive young cluster from larger distances, and the other is star formation in situ in a massive accretion disk. Then I will talk about some constraints that you can put on these models from a disk warping. Then even stronger constraints, as it turns out, can be put from the expected X-ray emission from young stars there. And I will show that this really implies a top-heavy IMF initial mass function for young stars formed there. And then I will end with implications for AGN and just for star formations. Theories of star formation in general. So this is Sir J. Starr. On the left, you see picture in the infrared in color, and partial alpha, I think. And in the contours, there are some molecular lines. So what you see is that there is actually quite a bit of cool and warm material around Sir J. Starr. And I should point out that 24 arc seconds, these are arc seconds here, is 1 per sec for the distance to the galactic center. So this is, the whole picture is several arc secs, per secs in size. And on the right, this is just a sketch of how things are oriented. Note that the galactic plane in this coordinates goes sort of across. The whole region is immersed in a supernova remnant, which is from several to perhaps 10,000 years old. This structure here in molecular lines is what people call the circumnuclear disk. And there is a debate how much it weighs, but somewhere between 10 to 4 and as much as 10 to 6 solar masses. And there are different levels of complexity that you can put in this picture and so on. But you can see that there is quite a bit of cool material there. On the other hand, in X-rays, you can see that there is also a lot of there's some X-ray emitting gas with temperature of a kV or so. This is shown in color here. from Baganov et al. And the previous infrared, near-infrared picture of cooler gas is overlaid, just for scale. But from emission, from a spectrum of the J star, we know that not much of this gas actually is accreting on the black hole. So, I guess the reason is that the cold gas can't get rid of its angular momentum, and the hot gas, sorry. On the relevant time scales. I mean, it's not clear how old is this cool gas there. I mean, they argue that even the larger CND is probably a million years old or so.
If the MRI were operative, that wouldn't be enough?
No. I mean, if you want to cast it in the usual, or in the simplest alpha prescription, right? Alpha of 1 would not be enough. You would need alpha of 100, let's say.
If you had alpha of 1, it would not be enough for the time scales.
Right, for the time scales, yeah. So, and the hot gas is just too hot and can't get rid of its, thermal energy in order to accrete. And so most of the hot gas actually is outflowing from this region rather than accreting. So, this is the SED of the J star. Don't look at the theoretical models. I'm not going to discuss these in this talk. Just look at the overall normalization of the spectrum. It's only of the order of 100 solar luminosities or so. And this is extremely little, considering that the black hole itself weighs 3 million solar masses, and there are stars there that are 10 to 5 solar luminosities or so. So the bottom line for this talk is that forget about gas and the supermassive black hole. Think stars, because stars really dominate the inner parsec of a galaxy. So this is a near-infrared observation of a galactic center, and on the right you have, in the middle, have free color picture there. And what you see is a bunch of stars. But just to emphasize how good these observations are, is that this is only 0.4 parsec in size, okay? So, while in our galaxies, people are proud if they can resolve regions of 10, 30 per second size. So, on the top of that, you're probably familiar with these so-called S stars. And this is really a blow-up of observations inside of this region there. This is only 0.5 arcsecond in size. And this is 10 arcseconds, right? So, and you see that we can actually resolve these orbits on the scales of 1,000 short radius or so. That's how we know that the supermassive black hole is there. That it weighs 3 million solar masses or so. But so now, for my talk, the interest is are these young stars, okay? The problem is that it's very difficult to form stars very close to supermassive black hole, because normally, if you think about a normal molecular cloud, it would be easily sheared by differential rotation. And to overcome that, you need the densities of 10 to 10 particles per cubic centimeter or so. And that's really unthinkable for usual molecular clouds in the galaxy. I should also mention that there are two levels to this puzzle. The first level, and the most difficult one, I think, is the stars that are most close in. Their orbits are elliptical and not oriented in any particular plane, but I'm not going to be talking about those, because actually This is a more complex region. There are more processes that can operate in principle. So I'm going to be concentrating on stars that are sort of around here. They are more massive and actually a bit younger, or perhaps a bit younger than the stars in the inner part. And a very interesting analysis was done a few years ago, originally by Levin and Belobrovtsev, who said, well, we know, or our observers know, 3D velocities for the stars. We know the errors in velocities there. And so what we can do is we can try to find a plane in the velocity space, you know, given by this normal vector n, that will minimize the reduced chi-squared quantity. And this is really the same as to look for a plane in which, if you plot stellar velocities, we will lie most closely in that plane. And it turns out that you can find, you can break the observed young stars into two groups, one clockwise on the sky and the other is counterclockwise. Okay? And the chi-squared you get from this are of the order of, well, depending on how many stars you include, because some of them are, you know, can be too far, and so the errors are unreliable and so on. But it's between 2 and 5 or so. And just to emphasize what this is significant is, if you just had a isotropic distribution of stars, then you would get chi-squared of the order of 15 up to 20 or so with this sort of errors. I played myself with data, so I convinced myself at least in this. So this is really significant. If you think about in terms of H over R for this stellar disk, then this disk is a bit better defined. It has probably H over R field of 0.2. The hour is probably 0.4 or so. So this is somewhat thicker disk. This is actually tricky because we don't have the third coordinate. So we know we projected a distance from the J star. We know, you know, we can measure x and y, but not the z coordinate. So you can really try to calculate z only making some assumptions, like, well, if the stars line up in velocity space, and these are only velocities, right? We're not coordinates here. Then you can say, if we're moving on then you can assume, well, we really are in that plane, each of the stars, right? And from what you can actually find z, and then you can try to build a 3D model for.
What are the error bars?
The error bars, and just velocities. Error bars and velocities.
The right plot, for example, which doesn't really look very convincing, at least to a naive observer. How much scatter is inherent in the error bars? What is, are those statistical estimated? Where do they come from?
First of all, I'm not the one who's observing and doing this analysis, but the projected.
Hard best to see a ring there.
Reinhardt is publishing another paper in a few months, and there are, you know, many more stars in there than in this data. Okay, this is remains statistically significant. And you know, points like this is actually of a different color. If I had this, you know, figure and right, but this is actually the worst of them, because you know, some stars can be too far in front. clue. Great. You got to do that. Yeah. Thanks.
Can I ask you a question? It's just a little bit off topic. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, if you're in a hurry, it's 10, 30 seconds. I remember in Cormier's original 1988 paper in, on M31, that one of the delightful things, I don't know if it held up or not, was that the central rotating disk was cold.
I don't know, but I do know that I mean, I'm aware of at least two observations, two recent papers where the stellar rings were also discovered in our galaxy on scales of I think one paper claimed 9 per sec, the other was further 30 per sec or so. That's the best you can do there. But we do start, you know, we do start to find similar stellar rings in our galaxies. So anyway, I'll have to move on on this. So this is just the orientation of these stellar rings, not radial extent. Radial extent is another matter, but the orientation is more or less like that. And just compare it with the galactic plane. So it has nothing to do with the galactic plane, which is already interesting, right, for a GN. I mean, it tells you that there are events in which you can have gas, which is presumably this, you know, the stars relocated from gas, right, with similar angular momentum orientation. So the gas came there with, you know, completely different angular momentum, which is, I mean, from the galactic plane, which I find interesting already.
That's found in general, in where you can find orientations in, near the centers of AGN and gas disks.
You mean from jets? You mean from jets?
No. Obscuration and so on. They're never correlated with the disk at large.
That's true. So anyway, so the first time, you know, when I heard about the stellar disks, I just thought, well, this should be evidence for star formation in a massive gravitationally unstable accretion disk. And this is just a small fraction of papers on the topic. I wrote down just a simplified form of this equation, which assumes pressure balance, vertical pressure balance in the disk. But basically, you want this Tumri Q parameter to be less than 1, which also means that the disk mass should be greater than black hole mass times H over R. And this, for standard-like disks, would be in the range between fraction of a percent to few percent, perhaps. So, and then also, you need to make sure that the gas can continue to cool as it collapses. Otherwise, it will, you know, stop the collapse, and that magnetic fields also do not prevent collapse. So in principle, it is not you know, guaranteed that even if the disk is massive enough, you will form a star. So you can in principle settle in what's called this self-regulated self-gravitating state, where the turbulence generated by self-gravity in the disk keeps it hot, and the disk does not collapse. But if you just do the isothermal calculations with Gadget, for example, this is just a run for myself to check that Gadget works. You can see that you can see, you know, gravitational collapse there. Now, this model is not really in favor, or hasn't been in favor, I would say, in the galactic center community because, you know, people think stars, because So people thought, well, it's much more natural to form stars away from the central parsec, perhaps at 10 parsec or 30 parsec. There we required gas densities for molecular cloud are normal, as elsewhere in the galaxy. And then that cluster could spiral in to the central parsec via dynamical friction. Okay, so here is just the estimate of dynamical friction time scale. And it becomes short enough, let's say a few million years, this is the estimated age of the stars, if the mass of a cluster is millions of solar masses, and this is the distance in parsec, so you don't want it to be too far or too wide, right? So the analytical estimates for this were just fine. However, when people started to do real simulations, real n-body simulations of this process, then we realized that, first of all, you need a very compact cluster, or the cluster would dissolve before reaching the inner parsec. So here is a simulation from Kim et al. What it shows the time in million years on this axis and the stellar density in just in color here. And what happens is that we start from a cluster which is there at 5 parsec, and then the cluster orbit decays by the dynamical friction. And as the cluster gets closer and closer to the central black hole, the tidal shearing rips the stars off. And so we end up in orbits on at these distances. So what you see is that the stars, the cluster is dissolved before reaching the central parsec. And so the stars really end up at several parsec distances, while what you want to do is to put them at 0.1, 0.2 parsec. Okay?
Actually, the cluster here could be a third of its central mass. Is this a two-body problem?
No, because when you're starting from 5 parsec, you should take into account the mass of the stars around the supermassive, the background stars, which is much higher than the central black hole in that case.
By how much?
Yeah, something like that. I think around 1.5 parsec or so, the mass of the stars, all the stars in the center, in the spherical cluster is of the order of the black hole mass. So around there, that must be, well, I think it goes linearly. So yeah, you're right. There are all sorts of problems with simulations if you look in detail. But at least this is, it already has a problem, right? Of course it would. You're right, but yeah. But presumably this happened, a few million years ago. So by now, presumably, such a star would come into equilibrium. Nobody really ever, tried to solve the n-body problem in detail, but that's an assumption. I don't think it's robust enough, really, because there are lots of stars around, so the, such a star could have just exchanged the momentum with the stars and came into equilibrium by now. So people suggested that perhaps you can have intermediate mass black hole formed inside of this cluster by core collapse. And in that case, it's much more difficult to strip the stars away from the cluster, because some of the stars are bound to the central black hole. So here is a simulation with a 10 to the 4 solar masses. And as you can see, some of the stars do end up in the central parsec here. However, most of the stars are still here. Yet the most sophisticated simulations by Fred Razio et al., for example, show that if you also put the mass segregation in these models, so the stars, you know, have some mass spectrum, not just one mass, which is the case here, then most of these stars are low mass stars, and the high mass stars are those that are, you know, in the center and more closely and more strongly bound to a black hole. So you really do have a separation that most of the massive stars end up here and the low mass stars here. So this would be, you know, somewhat consistent with observations. So so right now there is, you know, a debate between, I mean, in the community, trying to understand which model really explains the data. So what I thought in this regard is that, well, we have two rings there, right? So perhaps we can use some stellar dynamics or n-body constraints on the masses of these rings, and then just see how realistic the models become with these constraints. So one very trivial effect is this, that so what I'm doing is I'm just considering an orbit of one star and the potential of the other disk of stars, right? So if I had only the black hole, then of course I would conserve, you know, angular momentum exactly, and this orbit, if it is a circular orbit, would just remain there as it is, right? But if you have this disk, then you break the symmetry, and then what happens is the symmetry is only along this axis, and so this projection of the angular momentum from the star will be conserved, but not the projection in the plane of this disk. So the orbit will actually precess. And this is a trivial effect, of course. But the interesting thing is, if you take several such orbits, so circles, you know, with different radii, or maybe elliptical orbits with different parameters, they will precess at different rates. And so even if you started with a, you know, perfectly planar disk composed of this orbit like that, you would end up with something warped, right? And if it's warped too much, then you can say, well, this contradicts the data because we have this chi squared in the measured plane, right? So this is just a illustration and a side comment where, you know, I've computed similar warping done on an initially planar disk with a stellar ring inclined at 45 degrees to this disk. I'm not sure, don't remember exactly how it was positioned, but at 45 degrees with respect to this disk. And after a while, the times are actually in dynamical times here. You get, you know, very warped structure, and I think that may have something, may have some relevance to the obscuration and unification of AGN. But, you know, that's just a side comment as far as this top goes. So you can do analytical estimates. You can calculate the rate at which the this angle phi in the plane is increasing. And this is this precession frequency, the ratio of this precession frequency to the a Keplerian frequency is just given by linear ratio between the mass of the stellar ring. So this is the source which is, you know, making the orbit precess, right, to the mass of a black hole. And there is some geometrical factor here, depending on the radius of the ring and how large the, this is for circular orbit, so how large is the, what's the radius of the orbit is, and so on. So, roughly speaking, you expect that the precession will be of the order of this mass ratio times the number of orbits. And for Sagittarius star, the number of orbits in a few million years for the star is a few other thousand or so. So you see that some interesting constraints can be obtained for ring masses greater than 10 to the minus 3 or so. And of course, you need to do more careful calculation to say what it is, but it's an interesting mass ratio enough to. No, I mean, not on these estimates. No, here.
It's not part of stars which are moving.
Right. Not, so not here, but I mean, what I'm going to show now is just some results from in-body simulations where this, of course, is taken into account. So.
Differential precession
field. Differential. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I mean, this was just. Well, so this was the. Maximum possible effect estimate. So you assume that some part of the disk precesses at this rate, and some other doesn't precess at all. I mean, because if you have a large enough radial extent in the disk, this is basically what happens.
If you're looking at a ring being precessed by another ring, then it's the width of that. It's the precession.
No. So I mean. Yeah, the estimate is basically valid for a disk precessing in the field of a ring, if you want. So, yeah, I mean, if you had just two, infinitely thin rings, then there's nothing to talk about, really. Because, in that case, you would not, if a ring, if you have just a ring with stars on circular orbits, there's not going to be any differential precession, right? So you really need some radial extent or maybe elliptical orbits, right? So. Yes, right.
If you have waves propagating and in such a way that constant precession is going to be eliminated, that's exactly what Tony was discussing in the 60s.
That's not completely right. I mean, basically, you're right that you have two interactions. One interaction is between orbits in the different disks, and the other interaction is between orbits in the same disk, which will try to keep, the planar shape for the disk, right? But if you have much more mass in one of the systems, then you can see that, I mean, the limiting case is a massless disk warped by a massive ring. This is what was, what was calculated there. In that case, there is no self-gravity in the disk, right?
I'm not trying to understand what you're talking about. That. You say that you have a disk in which you have like partial precession through the disk. So
yes.
All the rings are connected with each other. And the
difference
is a different rate?
Yes, of course.
What
do you mean? I mean, if...
he's considering a kind of a test particle moving in a potential which is given by collection of stars, but he's not changing this collection of stars. He's having kind of two populations. One is test particles and another...
Only in the analytical estimates, only in for analytical estimates. Because in reality, of course...
reaction to this system which is providing the potential.
Yeah, anyway, so we can discuss this offline. Well, everything with what you said is in the n-body simulation. So... So this is just a detail, a detail that I will have to explain to you, because I have to move on, basically. So what I do here is very simple. This is a projection of the angular momentum vectors, in this how we call it, height of projections or something, but it's it just shows you that, you know, where are vectors point. If you had an orbit which, if a normal pointing directly to you, would be here on the line of sight, so it would be there. So the observed two disks are this one, the clockwise, and this is counterclockwise there. So I'm just populating the, you know, two disks with stars. So if orbits are consistent, more or less consistent with what we are, and then just running the code for a few million years and then looking at the orbits again and just, you know, measuring the chi-squared for these disks. So this is a case where the mass of these two systems, this is the total mass. And the one I call disk valve is the ring, and this is just for convenience. Really, I mean, the disk is this system, the ring is that system. So when the masses are small enough, the precession is small, and you get small chi-squared consistent with observations.
Is there a more star than
Yeah, right. But I mean, what we see is just the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, we see.
I know. I just want to understand. So you populated them with many more stars than.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. What we see now is about 100 of stars. Young star. But these are all, you know, massive stars. I think the at least 10 solar masses is the mass estimate for all those that they can dissolve. So this is a case where you increase the mass of these two systems by a lot, and in that case you have significant precession and also differential precession, which you see that some points really drift quite a bit, right? And that gives you chi-squared, which is comparable with the observations. And if you, so what I've done is I've run a lot of models with different mass ratios and found that, approximately speaking, the mass of the clockwise system cannot be greater than about 2 times 10 to the 4, and the counterclockwise system seems to be a bit larger, not in the radial extent, but it's farther away from the galactic center, from the black hole than this one. And so the constraints here are actually a bit smaller, so about 10 to the 4.
Is there a time scale? Is this for
some Yeah, this is for 3 million years, because 3 million years. I mean, the best estimated age of the stars is 4 million years, and it's plus minus 1 million years or so. We have, you know, some of the stars evolved into a Wolf-Rayet phase already. So, but this is a sort of interesting mass range, because if you just take the, you know, standard Shakur-Sinyaev disk model, which may be not too bad at these distances from the black hole, you'll estimate the disk mass where the disk becomes unstable at around 10 to the 4 solar masses or so. So even if all of disk mass went into stars, you would still, you know, be somewhat consistent with this, right? So now, what about the infalling star cluster case? In that case, the initial stellar orbits are actually different, because what happens is as the stars are peeled off from the intermediate mass black hole spiraling in, we're initially on orbits that are close, right, in space, to the orbit of a black hole. So we experience several close passages in which we gain excentricity. And even if the black hole has zero eccentricity as it spirals in, the stars still gain a significant eccentricity in that case. So the In that case, even at a given radius, you have orbits with, you know, you have more dispersion in the initial orbits, and so the disks get warped quicker and thickened quicker, and so you get smaller constraints on these masses, roughly by a factor of 2 to 3 or so. And if cluster's orbit is eccentric, then these limits are even lower, although I haven't really calculated those cases yet. So at first I thought, well, this really is killing this model, because the if I just take the realistic initial mass function from the stars and continue it from the observed stars, I would come to masses somewhat greater than this. But as I said, the realistic most advanced simulations show that the low mass stars, you know, remain at large radii because we peeled off from the cluster earlier than the high mass stars. So this actually can still be consistent. Now, just 2 weeks ago, I realized there's another constraint. This one is purely observational. And it comes from the observations of X-ray emission from young stars in the Orion nebula. In 2003, Chandra spent about 1 million seconds looking at this cluster. And last 2 months or so, there was several hundred pages of literature on AstroPH on this. And I was really glad I went through it, because I've learned a lot. And I think it, you know, has direct relevance to Sagittarius star. So the Orion nebula has about 2,000 identified young pre-main sequence stars. The total mass of the central cluster is about 1,000 solar masses and stars. The stellar ages range between 500,000 to a few million years. This is an interesting range, because we also have stars a few million years old. Then, in terms of masses, we go from basically substellar regime to 50 solar masses is the highest mass star we found. And the nice thing is that the initial mass function, which we can directly measure in that case, appears to be very close to what measured from the solar neighborhood and, you know, elsewhere. So it's a, you know, seems to be a very typical star-forming region, really. So the results in X-rays are that, first of all, we basically detected all of the identified stars in X-rays. And that also includes the really low luminosity stars. So the conclusion is that basically among pre-main sequence stars, there are no such thing as a X-ray quiet stars. This is a distribution and total X-ray luminosity, and this is for different mass ranges between 0.3, I think this one, 0.3 to, I'm confused now, but the there were three different curves there, and this is the lowest mass range, and this is the highest. I think this is 3 solar masses, between 1 and 3, something like that. And these are just a few high mass stars that we've seen. We just put them as points. So the interesting thing is, the X-ray emission is actually rotationally modulated with the stellar rotation. So they conclude that these are magnetic flares, like on the Sun, and not accretion disk. The X-ray luminosity actually decreases by a factor of several when we detect signatures of an accretion disk. Usually this means that we look at the in the infrared, if we have infrared access, which is just characteristic of disk reprocessing. And LX to L bolometric for the stars is as large as 10 to minus 3, which is a few orders of magnitude higher than for most, normal zero main sequence stars. Now, the other thing is some of the sources produce extremely strong X-ray flares. In one example, up to 0.1 solar luminosity, which is this flare there. And this is the time, and duration is a few orders of a day or so. Okay? And just a general statement that weaker flares occur daily, but the stronger flares like that seem to occur maybe once per year or so. This is very rare, but it does happen. So what we can do now is, well, we can say, let's assume that the first, let's think about the cluster and fall model, right? In that case, I mean, that model is strong in that it assumes, normal, well-observed star formation mode. So the IMF then should be somewhat close to the Orion, to normal IMF. And what you need is a million solar masses or so, right? Well, the Orion stars weigh about 1,000, so you expect that the expected X-ray luminosity of this young stellar object in the galactic center should be about 1,000 times that of the Orion cloud. So that should be something like 10 to 36 ergs per second. And presumably, I mean, we should be hiding in some, somewhere in the diffuse emission in the galactic center. And that goes more or less like this, beyond the central parsec. That it basically, this is radius of, I'm just looking at a circle around the J star. So the J star just, with some radius R cluster. Well, shouldn't call it cluster, just, the thing sort of area. And so what you see is that you need at least 30 per sec or so to hide this emission in the diffuse emission.
The sense is that these young stellar spectra are generally pretty soft.
No, they're hard. No. They have two components. One is soft, the other is hard, and we're about equal in the luminosity. This is actually the total X-ray luminosity, and this is the hard X-ray luminosity. So if you look, at least 3 keV.
At least 3 keV.
Yep.
Okay.
Those are, especially during X-ray flares. During X-ray flares, in fact, the spectra become even harder, and we can't even detect the rollover in the spectrum. I mean, So on one hand, you could, hide it in a, if you say, well, you started from really large distance, from 30 per sec or so, which is actually already a problem. If you look at those models, you really want to start with 5 or so per sec, because otherwise you don't get close enough to, you don't transport the young stars close enough. The other thing is, however, what about these X-ray flares, right, that are rare but bright? And actually, in a paper by Mike Milne et al. In 2004, they said that we've found five flares that look more or less like the expected flares from young stellar objects. So we noted that with the duty cycle measured in the Orion and other places, you can't really expect more than 5,000 young stellar objects there, while you need a million, right? So we actually made this note to discount the diffuse emission as coming from the some sort of hidden stellar population, but I think it's a very interesting point in the connection of if star formation of young stars there. So this really, I think, rules out the cluster model if IMF is more or less standard, right? Because I mean, there's at least two orders of magnitude disagreement. Now, if IMF is dominated by high mass stars, so what you had really just, let's say, this much of this many of low mass stars, like solar mass or so, then there's also a problem, because then you have to start with 10 to 5, 10 to 6 solar masses in high mass stars, but you see only, perhaps a couple thousand now, and they're only in the central parsec, not anywhere else. So I think this is a really, strong observational direct constraint on this model and really rule it out. Now, what about the star formation inside an accretion disk? The constraints here are slightly different in that what I'm assuming here is the following, that the stars, the low mass stars would be formed in the same disk where the high mass stars were formed. And because you can show that the migration time scale is long for the stars, they would still be there where the high mass stars are. So this is then the inner 5 arcseconds, or only 0.2 per sec of region. And actually these stars are even concentrated in the closer to the inner 2-3 arcseconds. So then in that case, the X-ray emission in the very center scales like this, more or less. This is the diffuse emission of the X-ray gas. And the expected is, a few other 20 times or so higher if the IMF is standard. So I think that, the low mass stars should be deficient in this disk by at least a factor of 10 or so. So you need, if you want a power law mass function for stars, then it means gamma less than 2. Well, for Peter MF is 2.35. So now, trying to understand what it means, first thing you can say, you can assume is perhaps the genes mass in the disk was very high, so that you just never formed low mass stars. But that appears difficult because, the estimates, show that it should be relatively small. This is, again, for Shakur-Sinyaev disk estimate here. And this is really, radius should be taken as somewhat smaller than this, but probably a factor of several. So you would see that it's definitely substellar. And of course, you also assumed here that, it scales as Eddington accretion rate. And so on. So I don't think that's the answer.
Another factor of 100 in alpha. So. Sorry, go on. None of us believe in alpha anyway. Go on.
Right. Well, you can do a different estimate, which is it's not clear that there was any inflow in this relatively short time scale, in terms of AGM. So you don't have to have, Shakur-Sinyaev, right? So you can just make estimate, say you have some mass there, and can you see how much mass is in the cube of dimensions of h or less, right? Depends on the q parameter, but and then you come out, you know, with similarly small numbers. So that's not the only way to make this estimate. So then in the literature on a high mass star formation, result of discussion on how to form the stars, the problem with accretion is that these stars are so luminous that basically they approach Wiginton limit, and so the simplest thing you can say is that stars above 10 solar masses or so cannot even be formed by, you know, accretion, accumulation of mass by accretion. Rather, it's, for example, mergers of lower mass stars. In this case, you can sort of test it in that we have too few low mass stars. And then we also know the densities, the stellar densities, so and those densities are low. So the only way where you could have the normal IMF, but then all the low mass stars somehow get and merge to form high mass stars is if you have large disks, for example, gas disks around high mass stars, and the there are suggestions that can help a stellar capture in this case, and you could probably merge, but I don't think it's very likely. I think most likely this is just evidence that gas accretion on stars can be extremely effective in forming high mass stars. And for star formation theories, really, I think this is a convincing evidence that the IMF is not really universal, that it really is a function of environment. And while for more theoretical view, I'm sure that this sounds, you know, quite reasonable, as it is to me, but in the literature, you'll find that the IMF in the galaxy seems to be, you know, quite similar from different regions, and so observers start to really take it, you know, for granted that it's the same everywhere. So for AGN, I think the implications are following that. First of all, that it's really first solid evidence that there is star formation in AGN disks. I mean, with resolved stars. It's evidence that you can probably put a major fraction of the disk mass in the stars rather than feed it on supermassive black hole. Then, if this is a general thing about a top heavy IMF for stars formed in a disk, then you will have more feedback because it happens on a shorter timescale. So the massive stars live much shorter lives, right? So that can be important for AGN tori because you have more stellar feedback. Then there's also a faster metal enrichment of AGN disks in this case, and this may be important for high Z quasars where we observe that the disks are already, have already significant metallicities. And finally, many of these high mass stars will presumably end up as stellar mass black holes. And this is interesting for possible gravitational wave radiation, as some of those you'll get closer to a massive black hole. So that's really it. That's it. And that's just conclusions. No.
Do you have any explanation for the kinematics of the S stars inside the inner of those two stellar disks?
No.
And yet they have a similar age to the stars in the disk.
Well, it's not completely clear that they have a similar age. I mean, those stars are less luminous and less massive were mainly B-type stars now, it seems. While, you know, these are Wolf Rayets, and so must have had a factor of several, at least, you know, more mass to begin with. So we can be a bit older, for example. That's one thing. The other thing is, some people argue that, you know, this could be very peculiar stars formed from red giants by stripping their envelopes, or, you know, by while passing close enough to a black hole or something like that. So there are, you know, more processes that, in principle, could form those stars, because they're closer in to the black hole, where, you know, you can have more interesting physics. I mean, the other thing is, people discuss a population of stellar mass black holes in the central parsec, because those black holes would also sink due to dynamical friction over, you know, the age of the galaxy, and the upper limit on the number of those, on the mass rather, of the stellar mass black holes is something like 5% of supermassive black hole, which is a lot. So if these guys preferentially reside, you know, in the inner 1 arcsecond, then this is where the S stars are, and that can, you know, interaction with this stellar mass black holes can, for example, change their orbits to more elliptical and so on. So I, at the moment, you know, I'm staying away from that topic, but there's a literature on that.
Talk a little more about how robust these ages of the stars are, both the S stars and the stars you're talking about. Can they be older stars that have been rejuvenated in some way?
Well, I mean, not going to discuss the stars, but these, I don't think we can be much older. I mean, because these are really, you know, Wolf Rayet stars that are losing mass at 10⁻⁴ solar masses per year. So, I mean, actually, some of them are LBV candidates. You know, so I don't think you can, yeah, 5 million years, I guess, all I can give. Maybe even less. When was this? I haven't read it, so. But is it not related to one of the X-ray binaries that they discovered? That also had a radio.
It claimed it was too luminous. And it looked like it was a little flare of a radio jet from the Sagittarius star.
And that was close.
That was the, you know, off the top of their head interpretation.
Oh, okay.
You can all go out and write alternate theory papers.
Okay, let's thank Sergey.